Following a strange childhood filled with fear and secrets, Pauline Dakin finally gets an explanation. Hers was a family on the run from the mafia, a shocking revelation. But was it true? Pauline Dakin gets at the truth in her new book, Run, Hide, Repeat, a memoir of a fugitive childhood. Dakin is a former CBC reporter. She currently teaches at the University of King's College.
Hi, Pauline.
Hi, Dawn.
Tell us about what you learned in a motel room at age 23 in the upper reaches of the St. John River Valley.
I knew there was something very strange about my family all the time I was growing up. My brother and I would talk about, what do you think it is? And a couple of times we had disappeared. We had moved away without telling anybody and turned up somewhere thousands of kilometers away and picked up the pieces again.
Six schools in 7 years when you were 11 years old and all that.
All that stuff. So when I was 23, my mother called and said, okay, I know you've had a lot of questions. Meet me at this motel room in Sussex. And I did, and I got into her car. We met at a gas station. She gave me a note that said, don't talk. I'll explain. Take off your jewelry and put it in this envelope. I'm like, what is going on here? We drove to the motel in silence, and when we walked in, here was this longtime family friend who was really like a dad to me. Who'd played quite a role in our lives earlier. And they sat me down.
This is Stan.
And they sat me down and told me that the reason we'd behaved so strangely was that we'd been on the run from the mafia since I was about 7.
Why?
Well, it was a very complex story, but it started with my father.
Your biological dad.
My real dad being involved in the mafia, being a kingpin in the Vancouver mafia.
And your mother knew some of his secrets. The mafia were, in cahoots with your father. They were worried your mother might go to the police.
Yeah. So my parents broke up, and it was a very difficult breakup. And my mom, first of all, went to counseling to this guy, Stan, who was a United Church minister and also had psychology training. And she said he'd saved her life because she was so depressed about, breaking up the family. So the story was that Stan had counseled previously a guy who was big in the waterfront mafia in Vancouver, and that when my mother, the wife of a supposed mafia kingpin, started coming to counseling, and then ultimately she worked for him briefly as a secretary, that they went, oh my God, they're getting ready to come after us in some way. So they were taking action.
And Stan is associated with a very mysterious group, which the RCMP don't know about, CSIS doesn't know about, nobody knows about. It's a kind of black ops operation that's run out of the Privy Council office, right?
That's right. This was a very secretive, shadowy, anti-organized crime task force. As you say, only the Privy Council was aware of it. And the idea was that they would provide protection for my family. So we had people sort of following us and protecting us. But it was also a place where people could go for protective custody if they'd gotten caught up in mafia stuff, as my family had. And so at one point, my mother was telling me that she had decided to go into protective custody. And
inside,
that's why they were telling me.
Inside.
Going inside. That was what I was told.
You know, there's some strange stuff in here. Well, I'm telling you, you lived it. You know, but like poison carpets, poison darts,
doubles.
But all kinds of sort of weird, funny stuff. But the suggestion was at one point you were here in Halifax, an apartment. There was a scuffle outside your apartment door. Stan tells you the next day that somebody's been killed.
Yeah.
Somebody from the good guys killed one of the bad guys. I mean, what they were suggesting was going on around you just out of sight was very, very serious and frightening.
It was. There was a period of time where I was very afraid and looking over my shoulder a lot.
When did your brother get the news at the same time you did?
A little bit later.
And when you talked about, when you both got the news, did you say, okay, well, it must be true because, A, our mother is a very moral person, a religious person, never lies to us, truthfulness is a big issue with her.
Yeah.
This guy's a United Church minister. Kind. You loved him.
I loved him. He was a good person.
There you go. So what's not to believe?
Well, you know, when I was told this, I immediately, I'm a journalist. I'm a young journalist, but I am, you know, hopefully a critical thinker. And I'm saying, this is insane. But, you know, in my, as my thinking evolved over time, I thought, you know, if I can't trust these two people who have always been there for me, who are, as you say, very kind of moral, engaged people trying to make the world a better place in their various ways. If I can't trust these two people, well, it's all over anyway. And so always there was this nagging, how could this be true? How could you have this other world, the weird world, that nobody would know about? I mean, I know how hard it is for anybody to keep a secret. We are uncovering stories all the time, right? But it always came back to that. I have to be able to trust these people.
So after the big reveal in the motel, mm-hmm. you know, you try to process as much as this, and you even get to a point where you say, you know what, maybe I'll go inside.
I did.
Which means disappearing, essentially, doesn't it?
It's walking away from your life
for everything.
Never being seen by anybody you know again, except maybe all those people I supposedly knew inside.
Take me through what you're thinking in that period.
The stories I was hearing as part of this were so intense and so big, you know. The implications, you know, were not just for my family, but so large, just overwhelming.
Yeah.
And it made my life seem irrelevant in some way. And it just shadowed everything else that was going on, my relationships. I mean, I had great friends. I loved them. But I couldn't talk to anybody about this. And so it isolated me so much. And I just thought, I'm going to stop now. I'm just going to go inside and see what kind of a life I can live there.
You set up a sting which enabled you to confirm to yourself, at least, that this was bogus.
Yeah. I began to, you know, we were still going on the run sometimes. There would be times I'd get a phone call and say, we got to go. And so we were spending a lot of time together, myself, me, and Mom and Stan. And I began to notice little patterns with him. Now, he had this, there was an entire world of this stuff in his head. He was brilliant. But I began to notice some inconsistencies or some little patterns. And I thought, that's it. I have to know. I mean, my entire life is on hold here. I have to know. And so, yeah, I at a time that I knew he was in the area, he had ostensibly, you know, retired on the West Coast, but he was here visiting quite frequently. And when I knew that he was here one time, I called my mother and said, my house has been broken into. What should I do? And you never called the police because, you know, they could be complicit with the mob. So she said, our friend is here. I'll talk to him and get back to you. And then I sat there for the worst 5 minutes of my life. And the phone rang and it was her. And she said, yes, they've picked some people up as they were coming out of your house. Your coverage was there. They knew they were in there. They'd been taking pictures of you for a while that they found in the back of their car. So, yeah, so immediately I knew, okay. There was no break-in. This isn't true. You know, it's using an opportunity to bolster the story. And it was devastating.
So you tell your mother and you tell Stan, look, nobody broke into my house. I'm sitting in my house. Everything's fine. Mm-hmm. What do they say?
Well, there must have been a mistake. We'll investigate. And my mother, I told her separately because I decided she'd been brainwashed. I mean, my mother would never have put us through this stuff if she didn't believe it. And she was horrified, but not because of the same reason I was. She was horrified because she felt, oh my God, if you have been turned, if you don't believe, if you're not part of us anymore, you will put yourself at risk. You will be in danger. So she was horrified. So they didn't believe it. They didn't believe me. They thought there'd been something go on.
Time passes. Stan passes away. Stan dies. Your mother's here with you over a protracted period of time, involved with you and your two daughters. I mean, part of your life in a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
But to the end, she believes, doesn't she?
To the very dying breath, she believed this. And she had to. I mean, when you think of what it would mean not to believe it, I think she would have not been able to get up.
Yeah.
You know, she would never have done this to her family if she didn't believe. And then the idea that it could have all been a hoax was too much ever to consider.
Coming toward the end, then, you decide that you have to find out what kind of business Stan was up to. So you actually make contact first with an American physician who's dealing with, in Stan's case, delusional disorder, this psychotic pathology here. Describe briefly what that is.
It's a really fascinating condition that is underreported, understudied, underrecognized. And there are a number of subtypes of it, but for I diagnosed Stan based on a paper that I came across in a medical journal, and he had two subtypes, one in which you feel that somebody's coming after you or intending you harm, and the other, which is about grandiosity, this idea that you know something other people don't know, or you have some secret intelligence or something like that. So all of these things really rung bells with me. But it's a condition where somebody has a delusion that is non-bizarre. So we know that people with schizophrenia can have very bizarre delusions. They could be hearing voices. They could be getting instructions from outer space, you know, very bizarre things. In this condition, there is a delusion that is probably not very likely, maybe very strange, but it's possible.
And this is Dr. Mancher, who tells you there's a guy who can tell you more about this. And
oh, it was so funny, Dawn. Yeah. I mean, I called him up and I said, you know, can I ask you some questions? And he said, you know, there's a guy in your neck of the woods, Dalhousie maybe, who is like the world expert on this. He's written the book on it. So yes, Alistair Munro is professor emeritus in the Department of Psychiatry at Dalhousie. And so I tracked him down and we had coffee. And he sort of confirmed my thinking, as Dr. Manschreck had done. And boy, those were some interesting conversations.
No doubt. With understanding came forgiveness, really, didn't it?
Knowing that there was nothing malevolent about this and that Stan was sick just was so freeing. And I didn't have to hate him, and I didn't have to be angry anymore. And it was just as though loads were falling off me as I made that realization. It was remarkable.
What a story.
What a story.
Thanks, Pauline.
You're welcome.
Pauline Dakin teaches journalism at the University of King's College. She's the author of Run, Hide, Repeat, a memoir of a fugitive childhood. It is published by Penguin Random House Books, and it's available in stores today. Now, this Thursday, you can join Pauline and Dawn at the Halifax Central Library for the book's official launch. Things get underway at 6:30 p.m.